Hello and welcome to another edition of Eight More Miles, the Louisville Metro Council District 8 podcast. This is Councilman Brandon Cohn. We're recording today on June the 10th, and my guest is Professor Bo Weston from Center College. I want to read you a little bit about Professor Weston, and then I'll tell you why he's our guest. Bo Weston joined the faculty at Center College in 1990 and was named Van Winkle Professor of Sociology in 2008. He's an energetic and active teacher known for getting involved in the lives and activities of students on campus. Born in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, Weston earned a BA with high honors from Swarthmore College and subsequently completed an MAR from Yale Divinity School and MA and PhD degrees at Yale University. Prior to coming to Center, Weston served for 3 years as a research associate in the Office of Research of the U.S. Department of Education. Weston has a special interest in the sociology of religion, especially in the Presbyterian Church. He's the author of Presbyterian Pluralism, Competition in a Protestant House, Leading from the Center, Strengthening the Pillars of the Church, and editor of Called to Teach, the Presbyterian Mission in Higher Education. Weston previously was an editor of and contributor to Education and the American Family, a synthesis of research published by New York University Press in 1989. His History of the College, Center College, Scholars, Gentlemen, Christians, was published in 2010. Weston also writes the blog The Gruntled Center, Exploring the Happy Society. This Center professor received considerable press attention for his course on coffee houses. In 2011, he was awarded a National Endowment for the Humanities grant to develop a course on the Happy Society. In 2004, he won the Kirk Award for Excellence in Teaching. In 2014, he again won the Kirk Award, as well as the David Hughes Professor of the Year Award from the Student Leadership Fraternity, Omicron Delta Kappa, and the Professor of the Year Award from the Delta 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 Sorority. Weston has presented papers at a number of professional meetings and has participated in the Kentucky Humanities Council Speakers Bureau. He has received honors, including membership in Pi Beta Kappa, and he served a term as president of the Anthropologists and Sociologists of Kentucky. Weston is an elder in the Presbyterian Church. He and his wife Susan have 3 children, Molly, Nora, and Rebecca. And I know you have at least one grandchild,
yes,
maybe
indeed.
More.
Let's see. One grandchild as of this month, little
That's
Fletcher.
Right. Congratulations. So, Professor Weston, the one thing that we did not read in your long and distinguished biography is that you are the author of a new book called Between Bohemia and Suburbia, Boburbia in the USA. And it is essentially a book about Louisville, Kentucky, and the neighborhoods of Louisville, Kentucky, and more specifically, the Highlands neighborhood of Louisville, Kentucky.
Right.
That's right?
That's exactly right.
And so when I, the reason I know about this and the reason we've met is that you reached out to me by sending me an email a couple of weeks ago saying, hey, Councilman Cohn, I wrote this book about the Highlands. Might you be interested in reading an excerpt? And of course, I was very excited to read it. Mm-hmm. You sent me about 40 or 50 pages of a 150-page book, which I absolutely devoured. And I wanted to figure out a way to talk to you in front of our constituents. And
excellent.
So by the time people are hearing this, you will have already have spoken at the St. Matthew's Eline Library
right.
about your book. But this podcast, I thought, was the best way to get you in front of our people, and I really appreciate you being here today.
Right, right. And I'm always happy to come back and talk in town about this subject.
You say come back and talk in town, and I know you teach at Center, which is in Kentucky, but
right.
how is it that you're so familiar with Louisville that you decided to write a book about it?
Right. Well, this work grew out of my work on coffee houses. And so my course on coffee houses, which is more serious than it sounds. Coffee houses really are places where the public sphere is created. Jürgen Habermas famously argued that. And with my class, we come to Louisville, and I send them out in car groups with cameras to make ethnographic films about independent coffee houses all over town. So I've come over the years to know pretty much every coffee house in Louisville and the neighborhoods in which they live. And those neighborhoods then also fed into the work I've been doing on happiness, because happiness has been dominated by psychologists, the study of happiness, but really sociologists are interested in what kind of makes a happy community, a community in which people can flourish. And I think those things go together, that the kind of neighborhood that fosters independent coffee houses also fosters a lot of other kinds of social interaction and spaces for social interaction. And so I got interested in what kind of neighborhood is it that's dense, walkable, mixed use, and what kind of people are attracted to it. And if you're in Danville, Kentucky, the nearest real city is Louisville, but also about a sixth of all center graduates live in Greater Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
So I had many former students who lived here and contacts all over town. So I thought this would be a good place to study. And I started in the Highlands. It was the area I knew best because that's where most of the coffee houses are, and came to know Crescent Hill as well. And I think those two neighborhoods really are the core of what I'm calling Boburbs. Now, what does that ridiculous name mean? David Brooks, some years ago, wrote a best-selling book called Bobos in Paradise, which is a pop-sosh book. And Bobos is a term he made up, which is a compound of bourgeois bohemians, right? They're people with a bourgeois work ethic, but bohemian cultural tastes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go studying bohemias, their artistic neighborhoods, often it's starving artists move into the cheapest place they can find. And if it works, they develop a critical mass and they start hanging out in coffee houses and they find art spaces to show their work in, and they itself become works of art themselves in their own lives. And that draws the Bobos, the bourgeois bohemians, as culture consumers, as people who don't want to live that life but are drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
And often what happens is the Bobos price out the bohos from living in those spaces and the bohemians move on. The best book about Bohemia, a book called Neo-Bohemia by a sociologist now at Vanderbilt, had the wonderful conclusion when he reviewed all the history of Bohemians going back to the 1830s, is that Bohemia is always already over.
Right.
Right. That as soon as you can name the place, the people there will say,
you
should have seen it 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And it moves around. And so the Greenwich Village in New York was once upon a time, it has now been yuppified, and in New York there's a number of bohemias. Louisville never really had a bohemia until the late 60s or early 70s, when the Highlands neighborhood declined enough that an accumulation of artists could start living there. And visual artists especially were drawn to it. One of the artists I interviewed said he came down there, he looked down Bardstown Road in the early 70s, and he said, I just love the jangle of it, I mean, the visual entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of musicians there. Vince Gill was just at Center recently, and he said when he was starting out, he lived in a house.
The Bluegrass Hotel,
exactly. And told stories about, you know, being a musician in a circle of musicians in those days. And that core, that first bohemia, worked. And it drew arts venues of various kinds and then the people who supported them. And the people who wanted that life started to rebuild the Highlands, which had declined notably. There were people who made an effort to save it, particularly the Cherokee Triangle, and created neighborhood associations, and the whole rich display of neighborhood associations up and down Bardstown Road really kind of grows out of that defensive motion from the early 70s.
A lot of which, I guess, is historic preservation of the architecture,
right,
to make sure that development didn't come in and change the physical character of the built environment.
Yes, and development both ways, you know, tearing down houses and building apartment buildings, but also turning old apartment buildings into transient, multi-student places. They worried about Old Louisville in particular as a model. When I started looking at what kind of neighborhoods become this place that needed a name, it was not bohemia, but it's definitely not suburbia, though maybe once upon a time it was suburbia.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
And so where do Bobos live? They live in Boburbia.
Okay, I'm gonna pause you there for
a
minute, because it's just sort of a nice introduction to what your book is about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an urban planner, although I'm an urbanist and an urban enthusiast.
Right.
And I found one of the parts of your book the most interesting in your observations about Boburbia, these kinds of neighborhoods like the Highlands, that they change over time.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you sort of think back to, I sort of picture a photograph from the Roaring Twenties of downtown Louisville. It's black and white. There's men in hats and suits, and there's movie theaters, and it looks like you're in New York City. There's just a dense urban center.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that during that time, there was the city, and then there was the countryside, the rural parts, and nothing in between. It's the city or the country. And then post-World War II, we had suburbia. I guess before then, but broadly speaking, in sort of the American landscape, you had the city gave way to the suburbs. The suburbs has even further given way to the exurbs, those way far out stretches.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about a boburb as being a place that is not necessarily have anything to do with the spatial geography from the city core. It doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily, it's not just an extension or something that's closer in. Is a Boberb a physical place or space, or is it just a set of cultural values? Right. Talk a little bit about that.
I think it helps to have a dense physical space. And as I've looked at them, I think the natural place for them to grow is along the old streetcar lines. And the streetcar lines were designed to create that kind of density, both of stores along the streetcar street itself and then close packed houses around that. And in the moment that they were built, especially before air conditioning and before television, the front porch was a real room. And so they're designed, and scientifically after a while, to be front porch places that are close enough to the street that you can sit on the porch and talk to the pedestrians without shouting. And even to this day, the conversations between the dog walkers and the porch sitters is part of the glue that holds together such neighborhoods. And that density then becomes the place that you would look to find a Boberb now. Now, when you look at when the streetcars were built in Louisville, they were especially drawn to the series of Olmsted Parks, the emeralds around the city. And those places are the best bet. They're the ones that worked now. So the Bardstown Road, which goes down by Cave Hill Cemetery, which sort of precedes the parks, and then Cherokee Park, and then Seneca. And then on the other side of it, Frankfort Avenue through Crescent Hill, those are the old streetcar lines that become the core Boberbs.
Mm-hmm.
If you look out further, you think someday, maybe, all the way down to Iroquois, that Southern Parkway, which was designed to be that same kind of thing, might develop in that way. And I'm looking at, if you imagine a future more multiracial Boberb, where would you look for it? And I would look for it in Russell and Shawnee going out to Shawnee Park.
Hmm.
Now, right now, that's a little hard to imagine. But the developments that are happening in Portland now build upon that same set of bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if it works, it will spill over at some point and begin, it's already actually started, that redevelopment along the three streets going out from downtown to Shawnee Park.
I guess I just find it interesting that the Highlands, the Boberb, it was a streetcar suburb. It was a mm-hmm. suburb first.
Exactly.
And it's sort of almost counterintuitive to think that out of a suburb grew Bohemia.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of needed to have a deteriorating suburb in order
right.
for Bohemia to set foot. And then I guess you would say Boberbia came in and sort of gentrified Bohemia.
Yes.
But it started with a suburb.
Yeah. And it helps to have those bones of some bigger houses and a bunch of stores. If you're starting from scratch in a really industrial neighborhood
mm-hmm.
or a full-on suburb that was purely residential, it would be harder to build a Boberb.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they will move in the ecology of this city around, just as every other kind of neighborhood has. And if you think of the history of Louisville, you can plot it by a series of perimeter roads to which the suburbs of the day grew and then beyond. So once upon a time, Broadway was the outer perimeter. And then when Eastern Parkway was built, the neighborhoods around Broadway became not suburbs anymore, but the inner city. And then to the Waterson, and now we're out to the Snyder. One can imagine an even further out perimeter. It's hard to imagine right now, but such a thing could happen.
Yeah.
That would someday make Lake Forest an inner suburb of gigantic Louisville.
Yeah, that's really hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine right now, yes.
Well, in your book, Between Bohemia and Suburbia,
right.
Boberbia in the USA,
mm-hmm.
the title suggests that the three spaces or places, and
mm-hmm.
I know there's a distinction, that we're interested in, the three
mm-hmm.
types of places
types
are Bohemia,
places.
Suburbia, and Boberbia.
Right.
So not necessarily today's central business district, although
mm-hmm.
it's its own sort of publicly funded, sort of gentrified. It's nothing like the downtown of the past, really.
Right.
It's built
right.
around these massive amenities and catered to tourists, and it's not mixed use. There's no grocery. It's sort of a fabricated kind of a place.
Yeah.
And then, sort of, this book is not about rural America, really, anymore.
No. Nor is it about ghettos.
Okay, right.
I interviewed college graduates on the theory that they have choice about where to live.
And when you say ghetto, you just mean a part of the city that has almost like a perpetual underclass from entrenched poverty.
Right, concentrated poverty.
Which
exactly.
stems from all sorts of other reasons.
Exactly.
But it's not about that, too. It's about those three types of neighborhoods: bohemia, suburbia, and boburbia.
Right.
And you talked about bohemia being really more of an idea than mm-hmm. a place, even though I guess you might argue that some of the upcoming, sort of the newer, hipper places are more bohemia than they are boburbia.
Right.
We can talk
exactly.
about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But from the excerpt you sent me, at least, mm-hmm. most of the comparison and contrasting was done between bohemia and suburbia,
right.
which I found very interesting.
Yes.
And I'm going to talk about that a lot, but for me, the term bobo, and I read David Brooks' book when I was in college,
mm-hmm.
10 or 15, or longer than that, 15, yeah. or 15 or 20 years ago, I loved the book. I thought it was so interesting. And to mm-hmm. me, the bobos described my parents' generation.
Right.
You know, my mom generally was someone who was from Boston, who, you know, probably was burning her bra in protest of the war in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
but then also moved her kids to the suburbs and has a house full of nice stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's my Pier 1 imports and whatever it is, but
right.
this generation who really their self-identity comes from that time in their youth, it was really rooted in values and politics and in a really fast-changing world,
mm-hmm.
have sort of grown up to become, you know, our parents who have stuff like everybody else.
Right.
And who I think mostly live in the suburbs now as opposed right. to the boburbs, even though when I was a kid and my parents were young, they lived in the Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Talk to me a little bit high level about the boburbs versus the suburbs and how both options are really sort of consumer choices.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very different consumer choices, but
right.
but they're maybe more alike than different on the superficial
right.
level.
Well, and the first point is they're choices, right? They're people who have choices can choose to live there. And a further confusing thing is that many of the people who will end up in the suburbs start out in the boburbs,
mm-hmm.
right? They graduate from college, and they move to the boburbs in their bar-going, mate-selecting years and hang out at center. It's almost a rite of passage that if you don't know what to do with your life, you and your fraternity brothers, sorority sisters get an apartment in the Highlands or in Crescent Hill and find stuff to do and start the rest of your life. And then the question will be, you do find your mate, you do get married, you do think about kids. And the norm, the default for Americans for 100 years almost now is you move to the suburbs to raise children.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's really what they're for.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of people who want to raise children in the boburb is a distinctive type.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that really was, of all of the questions that came along with this research, that really was the one that I was most interested in. Right? They're at that moment of the big choice
mm-hmm.
of where to raise children, of where to raise the next generation. And some took it for granted that the city is too dangerous for children and it's too dirty. And of course we want space and control.
Mm-hmm.
And so you move to the suburbs. And other folks said, no, I want my kids to be street smart. I want them to see diversity. I want them to have some choice about what to do themselves and not be driven everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And those differences become based on or embedded in or connected to deeper differences still. So the last part of the book is really a deeper and deeper analysis of what are the things that divide those two different ways of living and two different worldviews.
Really getting into sort of the politics and the economics and the
right.
culture of the different types of people. I mean, you don't have to be a political science to sort of know, to look at a map during a national election and see that, you know, the cities are bluer and the suburbs are redder,
right.
generally. And that there's obviously mm-hmm. shades of everything in between and everyone yeah. everywhere.
And in fact, to take the nuance of that, so if I think about the layers, the first one is kids, not kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even married people, college graduates, both jobs without kids and don't plan to, the classic gay neighborhood, stays in the city,
mm-hmm.
right? But if they do have kids, then we look at liberals versus conservatives. And it's not just that cities are generally more liberal or more democratic than the suburbs, but the parts of the cities. So the boburbs tend to be the bluest part of town.
Mm-hmm.
Not only are they most liberal, they're most likely to vote. So if you look at even neighborhoods around them that are as liberal in their leaning, they're just much less likely to vote.
And they're not just the most political, I think, as you point in your book. They're the most involved in government.
They're involved in government, exactly.
They send their council people the most emails and have the most thoughts and opinions on different stuff that's going on.
One of the questions I asked, in addition to about 180 interviews, I did a survey of 500 Center alums. And one of the questions I asked was, do you know who your Metro Council member is, mm-hmm. and have you ever met that person? And the Boburb people were much more likely than the suburbanites to have both of those things, to say yes to both of those things.
Which is a real strength, I mean, for I think, in terms of, having a lot of other stakeholders who are able mm-hmm. to contribute to the overall health of the place.
Exactly. And likewise, the suburbs, particularly the furthest out ones, the exurbs, are the most conservative places. So Lake Forest is a neighborhood that I look at in particular. It is a large, large house neighborhood. If you ask realtors off the record, where are the McMansions? Mm-hmm. They'll say Lake Forest, right? It's where the central street is, Arnold Palmer Drive. It gives mm-hmm. you sort of a clue what it is. That was the precinct with the highest Trump vote in this last election mm-hmm. In the entire county. And that difference then shows up in many, many other ways. The next layer below that here we get a little sociology with some footnotes. Pierre Bourdieu, a French sociologist, wrote about not just rich versus poor, the sort of vertical dimension of stratification, but what kind of capital you have, the composition of capital. And he says, even within the same level, right, even with the same amount of general money and status, some people have more money and mm-hmm. and get their status from money, and some have more culture, right? And his terms are not at all helpful. So the terms I use is the corporate class and the knowledge class. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge class, you'll following the story, will know they love the Boburbs. They're the core people who like the Boburbs, right? People who make their living from the control of knowledge one way and another, who also tend to be more liberals, who also tend to want to raise their children with diversity and to see a range of people. They love the Boburbs. The corporate class tends to gravitate toward the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And then if we go to the deepest level, it really comes down to a question of worldview, right? Do you think the world is a rich, interesting, and varied place that you want to experience the variety of? Or is it a dangerous and scary place that you really have to control all interactions so that you can protect your family from? Mm-hmm. And then I think it's hard to explain why, you know, people who could have been roommates, one sees the world one way and one sees the world the other way. And that's where we get to the limits of social science.
So let me ask this question, because again, I was a small child in the Highlands. Mm-hmm. I was a formative teenager and grew up. My parents still live out mm-hmm. in the East End.
Right.
The suburbs, not the exurbs.
Right.
I have a 15-month-old little boy, my wife and I are both this type of people. You could probably peg us with mm-hmm. what we do in our careers and the kind of things we're interested in, what we like. I love where I live. I love my street. I love my neighborhood. I love everything about the Highlands. Mm-hmm. However, there's sure a lot of creaky stairs in my house, and I have to carry a lot of stuff up and down, mm-hmm. and I wish I had a bigger yard for my dog to run around in. And, you know, they don't have just great atomic ranch houses in the Highlands with big lots for most people.
Exactly.
You know, unless you're very wealthy, it's hard to find everything that you want. Mm-hmm. And so I can understand the drive out to the suburbs,
right?
Especially if you have children, older mm-hmm. children. I've also noticed that the suburbs here in Louisville and across the country are increasingly becoming more diverse and more interesting, now at a slower pace. Now, mm-hmm. that they are very diverse ethnically, especially from internationals. I know more mm-hmm. international people move to the suburbs because it's generally cheaper.
Right.
It's becoming more racially diverse for mm-hmm. people that have choice. Whether it's you're noticing that there's more local restaurants opening up in Louisville's East End, or mm-hmm. whether you're noticing that in cities like New York and Boston, the suburbs, they feel just as urban as most of the most urban parts of Louisville do. Mm-hmm. Is the changing suburb to accommodate the Boburbs' tastes?
Right.
Going to really stick a knife in the streetcar suburbs of today as we know them and mm-hmm. be able to offer everything, all the culture I want to consume, if I can go get it in the East End, then what's left for me here kind of thing?
Well, you could certainly get more house for the money in the suburbs. But you also have to drive everywhere, mm-hmm. right? So one of the things I start with was the Pew Polarization Survey in 2014 asked this question. Imagine you're moving to a new place and you have a choice of either bigger houses, but they're further apart and you have to drive to schools and stores and restaurants and stuff, or smaller houses closer together, but you can walk to those things. Which would you prefer? And this was two interesting things came from this. One, Americans are evenly divided, right? It was 49% to 48%. Mm-hmm. And two, nearly everyone can answer that question. And so I asked it of all my interviewees, and for nearly everyone, it was an easy question to answer. Some of them shivered at the thought of living in the other place. Mm-hmm. Right? It really was a divider. And that walkability was a clue. And some other interviewees said a thing which was helpful to me. It says, it's sort of like living on campus. And that is, when you think about when you live on campus, you live in a little tiny cell, right? But you don't feel trapped by that because it's not the only place you live. You live on the whole campus, right? All of the public facilities are yours. You don't mind sharing them with other people. In fact, mm-hmm. that's a virtue. You get to see others. You get diversity. You get variety. You get to see your friends. You have sociability. And I think that's a crucial difference, right? If you look at the public amenities as yours, too, right? If Cherokee Park is the place you play,
sure,
that's way better than any house land you could have.
Or the coffee houses where you meet your friends, or the bars where you
meet your friend. Exactly. Yes. You know, I conducted a lot of these interviews in coffee houses. And in fact, the people who like to hang around in coffee houses were generally more open to having this conversation, right? They liked to tell me why they lived where they lived. They would often tell me a lot of other stuff too. And it was really hard to get interviews in the suburbs, in part because there's no place to meet. Mm-hmm. Right, every place was a controlled space, and the people in the suburbs in general were just way more suspicious of being asked questions about why they did what they did, mm-hmm. and that became a secondary research question. I would ask them. It would be my own students' parents would grudgingly agree to be interviewed, but their first question was, you know, what do you want to know?
Why? Yeah.
How could this come back to hurt me? Right. That goes to the worldview issue, but as you think of, you know, where you want to raise your kid. If your kid can only play in your yard, the Highlands are a real constraint. If your kid can play in the entirety of the city,
sure,
you got everything.
I tend to think that sort of a retrofitting of suburbia as we know it today is an inevitable thing that's going to be a positive thing, that's going to be driven by consumer taste, and that's really going to, I think, probably fuel the economy of cities for the next 20 or 40 years.
Yeah.
Because people that live in the suburbs say, hey, look, just because I have a big yard and a house doesn't mean I don't want to walk to get a cup of coffee too. I used to do that when I was 25. Mm-hmm. I want better public transportation. I don't want to have to get in my car.
Right.
And so you can imagine a retrofitting of suburbia, again, which I think would be a very good thing. And should happen, and will probably lead to some dramatic changes. But my question is, I worry about the first ring suburbs like the Highlands and like the other neighborhoods in your book, because as I sort of mentioned before, public tax dollars have been subsidizing the resurgence of central business districts for a long time. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on arenas and hotels and those things.
Right.
And then sort of unrestrained market forces are leading to sort of, you know, sprawl type suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
And now again, those are, I don't want to get into it, those are sort of subsidized by policy decisions
they
too.
They are, yes indeed.
For land and roads
for
and
roads
sewers
especially.
And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, so you're seeing the growth in the suburbs,
mm-hmm.
you're seeing the investment in the core, and even as I sort of have to compete for other priorities in our city budget and other things,
mm-hmm.
I'm not seeing the kinds of investment in the neighborhoods like the Highlands that I think the city takes for granted.
Yeah.
Because they think, oh, the Highlands is great, but it really has a lot of infrastructure to maintain. It needs to make sure it stays clean and safe and all those kinds of things.
Right.
And I've heard this before, that those first ring suburbs are sort of in jeopardy. Is that something that you've observed or that you think is true? Or where is the future of sort of the Highlands and neighborhoods like it over the next 10 or 20 years?
I think they're inherently appealing to people who want to engage the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I anticipate that every generation will have a bunch of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that someone will try to create Boburb someplace.
Like Norton Commons.
Like Norton Commons. Something. Now, what's interesting about Norton Commons is they explicitly based it on the Highlands, right? They came and looked at the Highlands, said, we want to do that, but way out in the edge of the county and self-contained. And I have some of the people I interviewed early in the Highlands moved to Norton Commons because they got a lot of the same benefit, but in a new house that wasn't so creaky, right? But but it is far away. And unless you actually work in Norton Commons, you're driving.
It's actually nothing like the Highlands, really.
And it's the folks, there are people in the Norton Commons who love it a lot.
Right.
There are people in the Highlands who tend to use the words like Stepford or Disney or fake.
Right. I mean,
those are differences of taste. Now, I will say, though, in answer to your question, what's happening in Nulu and in Portland may be the interesting alternative development, right? Mm-hmm. So they're overwhelmingly commercial. They're not city government. They're not government funded primarily, right? They're a mix of arts-based and environment-based investors, but trying to make interesting places.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of working, right? It's, as I call them, the Germantown is the old-fashioned Bohemia, what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And Portland and Nulu are Bohemia on steroids.
It's sort of a mix. I mean, I feel like you said Nulu and...
And Portland.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a mix, especially... In Portland, there seems to be more sort of authentic Bohemia in Portland than there is in East Market Street. I mean, Nulu is just a combination of Phoenix Hill and Butchertown that has a sort of another name slapped on it, and it seems to have maybe hit. Certainly, it hasn't reached its potential in terms of development. If you look at the Pearl District or something like that, which I know you compare the Highlands to, interestingly.
Yeah.
But it seems to have sort of tipped. In terms of the commercial corridor, at least.
Well, the problem that Nulu, the East Market, always had was it wasn't residential at all, and so it couldn't have been a Bohemia. I mean, it went more like Skid Row to Bohemia,
right?
From an investment commercially. Portland, on the other hand, is a residential neighborhood. There's lots and lots of places to develop that. And, of course, it's the same people. I mean, Skill Holland just moved his headquarters over to Portland and has got Honey Brothers to move there as well.
Yeah.
And there's a coffee house and there's a bookstore and the U of L is moving its art facility there. I mean, it's got potential. And I'm writing this book now knowing that the situation is fluid, but make some guesses about what might happen over the next 20 years.
Right.
The problem that the Highland faces... is that it's pricing out even the young Bobos. And that's a challenge. I mean, that is a real challenge. And that may be, you know, why Bobos don't live in the East Village anymore.
Right.
They've moved to Brooklyn.
Right. And so I guess you'd suggest that affordable housing should be a policy priority for people who represent places like the Highlands.
In order to
preserve. And it is for me.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot you can do.
Yeah, but one of the huge advantages that the Bobos have, that the Burbs have, is a great variety of kinds of housing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a real weakness of the subdivision, is that there's basically only one kind of house. And so only one kind of family and one kind of class position can afford to live there.
Yeah.
Whereas there's all different kinds of age moments, life cycle moments, class positions. You know, some people can still buy the big house on the boulevard, and some live in the grandma apartment that's above the garage in the same neighborhood, and that's a great gift to diversity.
Before I move on to talk a little bit about the Highlands compared to other Louisville neighborhoods and other Highlands-type neighborhoods in other cities,
right?
You know, I think a lot of people in the Highlands think of themselves as living in the city because maybe they've never lived in the city. Like, if you live in New York, you live in the city. You
right.
know, if you don't... you know, if you live in the Highlands and you're from downtown Boston, it seems like a suburban kind of a lifestyle to you, or at least a. Is there any neighborhood in Louisville that you consider to be true urban living?
I think actually, when you go to big cities, people who live in the high rises near downtown, that we can't really replicate here.
Right.
But people who live in brownstone neighborhoods or their equivalents.
Old Louisville?
Old Louisville, and, you know, Old Louisville is modeled on the New York brownstones. But that variety, I mean, as you mentioned, I have a grandson, and they live in Brooklyn Heights, and so we just spent a month in Brooklyn Heights. And the huge variety of eras of building there is more like the Highlands. I mean, it's more like that mix. It's a little denser, it's more brownstone-y than bungalow, but, you know, you go out a mile from there, and you're in places that are like what we have here. And I think most cities, cities that were ever big enough to have had streetcars, can have dense enough, but single house living, as we have here.
So in your book, you talk about these different varieties of the Boburbs. Crescent Hill.
Yeah.
How are Crescent Hill and the Highlands similar and different in terms of your sort of analysis of suburbs?
Right.
Would you say that they're the two most analogous of Louisville's Boburbs?
They are, yes. And I think, as I say, Crescent Hill is a more bourgeois Boburb.
Kind of West Village, East Village thing?
Yes, though those are terms of ages ago.
Right.
Okay. I just made my Jane Jacobs pilgrimage to Hudson Street, but Hudson Street isn't really Hudson Street anymore.
Yeah.
And in part because it was never industrialized, as Crescent Hill wasn't. It was more exclusive by race and class. And let me just say as a digression here, one of the crucial issues in studying any kind of suburbs and housing is racial exclusion. And a really interesting feature of this study was that almost nobody, black, white, and otherwise, said that the suburbs or the Boburbs were racially exclusive in their personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They weren't steered, they weren't excluded, they didn't run into ugliness. Other kind of neighborhoods, that would probably be so. But the black middle class people I talked to, there isn't a black middle class neighborhood in Louisville, it's just not big enough.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not, if they wanted the suburbs, they went to a suburb. If they wanted the Boburbs, they went to the Boburbs.
Right.
Class exclusion is the core of both kinds of neighborhoods. But the racial exclusion of the past really is diminished a lot. And immigrants and persons of other ethnicities, I mean, this is the South, so black and white is the core issue, report even less difficulty. They sometimes said it felt weird to be the only person of color in wherever I was living, and that drew them more into the city.
Mm-hmm.
But in the car suburbs in here, if your money was green, generally that was the crucial issue.
Only color that matters.
The only color that matters, right.
So you were saying about Crescent Hill.
So Crescent Hill was also a streetcar suburb. It was developed, Frankfort Avenue developed similarly to Bardstown Road. Clifton is the sort of more bohemian industrial end in the way that Germantown now is the bohemian industrial counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that happened in the development of Crescent Hill was when people wanted to open restaurants and stores and independent things in Highlands but couldn't find a place, they spilled over. And once they spilled over to Crescent Hill, Crescent Hill changed its rules, particularly about alcohol sales, that made it a much more inviting place.
Mm-hmm.
I had a student who said, you live in the Highlands in your pot-smoking years, and then when you grow up, you move to Crescent Hill, which is, in fact, what she did herself.
That's funny. I won't
name her, but that did make some sense to me in the distinction of the two.
What about some of these other Boburbs that you write about in the book? Travis Heights in Austin, Wicker Park in Chicago, Fishtown in Philadelphia, Virginia Highland in Atlanta, the Pearl District I mentioned in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
How did the Highlands, our Louisville Highlands, generally compare and contrast to any of these other neighborhoods?
Right. Very similar. They each have a somewhat different history. So Virginia Highland in Atlanta was probably the most comparable.
And my brother lives there, which would make sense.
Right. And you know, it was a streetcar defined neighborhood, and dense packed bungalows. Wicker Park I picked because it's the subject of neo-bohemia. It has now, the Bobos came there. It's richer now, but it was more industrial to begin with. The Pearl District was an industrial place. It was not residential at all. When I did survey data, though, from people in those places compared to here, they were really quite comparable. My survey data from the Highlands was center people, and that was a wider sample than I think the town itself has. The non-white ethnic group varies by region, so way more Hispanic in Texas and way more black in at Georgia and way more Asian in Portland, but the mix was similar, the appeal was similar. Really, it was how long they had been Bobos. So Fishtown is happening right now.
Right.
Whereas the Highlands and Virginia Highland have been that way for quite a while.
So as the oldest of those kind of Boburbs. Mm. One of the other ways I sort of think that the Highlands is, under attack is the wrong phrase, but changing or competing with the suburbs is the displacement of local independent businesses, right. The rise of chains. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's true everywhere from Times Square in Manhattan to every Boburb and streetcar suburb across America. I don't know the last time you were in the Highlands here in Louisville, but how do you see the amount of how do you see us holding up in terms of our mix of local independent businesses versus some of the suburban culture infiltrating us and our ability to resist that?
Yeah, you know, the symbol really is Urban Outfitters, I think, and it stands in for a whole bunch of other chains that try to trade on a Bobo vibe.
Yeah.
But our chains, right? And so my students, some of whom are from here, say the suburban kids come in, they go to the vintage stores, they look, and then they go to Urban Outfitters to try to buy a thing that looks like that.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the actual Bobo kids go to the vintage store and make their own choices.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the success draws. I mean, that's a natural challenge. It is the thing that the aging hippies who still live in the Highlands worry about, is that the chains will destroy the character of the thing. But if you step back and take the larger view, cities are ecologies. Mm-hmm. Kinds of neighborhoods flow around a city.
So would policy, I don't know, you know, I don't have the whole book. I'm looking forward to reading it. Does it make policy recommendations? We talk a little bit on the show about affordable housing. I assume preservation, you know, for all the struggles that in politics that entails, that actually preserving the architecture and the culture of the place, public space protection and proliferation, creating more places, both public and third places where people are welcome. Those are really the strategies for the Highlands to be able to continue and thrive in, you know, the times that we live in.
Yes.
To do what we do and do more of it.
Yes. I don't make policy recommendations. The wheel is in spin. But just the story I tell is of people who loved the place, made it a distinctive place, and they did that by using the tools of zoning, essentially, to save it. And places that are loved can be saved and transformed and made whole. One of the subsections has what I thought was a great pun. My wife is not as happy about it.
I'm a pun guy.
Of the Highlands and the Glens, right? So if you think about any subdivision, it has a name like that. And there's a lot of people who want to live in the suburbs and want to raise their kids in the suburbs, but almost none of them have the loyalty to their particular subdivision that people do to the Highlands, right? The Highlands is a place.
The suburbs are spaces,
exactly. Right. And one would do as well as another. And you could imagine perhaps someday someone will love some subdivision enough to preserve it. But it's harder to imagine than in the places that become Boburbs.
If they don't preserve them and then they deteriorate, then eventually they become Bohemia, then eventually they can become Boburbia.
Yeah, they're Bohemia with really big houses and no public transportation. I mean, subdivisions are designed to keep strangers out.
Yeah.
And that's a crucial difference from a thing that was designed to be part of the urban grid.
Yeah. Well, it's all very fascinating. And, you know, I really look forward to devouring the entire book. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the book, where people can get it, how else they can read about this, where they can read your writing, that sort of a thing.
Right. And I have to start with an apology.
No problem.
I am grateful to Routledge for publishing this book, and it's a handsome-looking volume, and they priced it at $140.
Whoa.
I think they're thinking...
But you can download it.
Only libraries buy books anymore. There's an electronic version, a Kindle version, which is about $50. You can rent the electronic version for $30.
Yeah, there's some affordable ways to get it.
Or... just write to me,
okay.
And I'll send you a big extract, because really, you know, I'm not in this business to sell books. I'm in this business to spread ideas.
Right. And then what about your blog? Is that something where people could find continuing coverage of this, or Twitter, any of that other kind of stuff?
The blog, the Gruntled Center, right, grows out of that same work on happiness and flourishing communities. And that has many of the ideas that are in the book started out as blog posts of thought pieces that I was thinking about. So as I continue to develop this notion, yes, the Gruntled Center is a good spot to look for.
Okay. Well, I know that I could not even possibly begin to do justice to even the excerpt of the book that you sent me. I thought that so many of the observations were really keen and interesting. And again, I haven't even been able to see the whole book. So I'd love to get the excerpt or the book in front of as many listeners and people's eyes as possible so they can contact me if they have an interest, and I can put you in touch with Professor Weston or those resources otherwise. But I just want to thank you for your scholarship and for your interest in our city and in our little Highlands neighborhood. We think we're pretty great, and we intend to be here for a long time.
Yes, I thank you very much for talking to me, for having the Highlands. My own youngest child lives in Clifton now.
Okay.
So I have occasion to be in the city regularly as well. And you keep all my coffee houses for me. So
okay. Well, maybe we can set something up. We can do a little reading or meeting in a coffee house sometime.
I'd welcome that.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bo Weston. Thanks for listening to 8 More Miles, the Louisville Metro Council District 8 podcast. I'm Councilman Brandon Cohn. Please stay in touch with our office. Visit our website at www.tinyurl.com/cmcohnd8. And once you're there, please subscribe and stay informed to receive our biweekly e-newsletter.